Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A lack of investment in less wealthy nations is a major obstacle to sustainable development, the UN's trade and development body UNCTAD said on Wednesday. Here's UNCTAD Secretary General Rebecca Greenspan presenting the latest global trends in foreign direct investment.
Developing countries face an investment gap of $2.2 trillion annually for the energy transition. This is more or less half of the funding gap for the Sustainable Development Goals. We have talked about a $4 trillion gap in investments for the Sustainable Development Goals.
Ms. Greenspan reported that while investment in renewable energy has nearly tripled since the adoption of the Paris Agreement almost 8 years ago, poorer states have been largely left out. The top UN official also stressed how much the Global South needed two key agreements, the Black Sea Initiative for the exports of grain from Ukraine to global markets, and the Memorandum of Understanding signed between Russia and the UN to boost Russian exports of food and fertilizers, to continue bringing prices down and stabilize world markets. Launched in July 2022 in Istanbul, the initiative is up for renewal later this month. Demonstrations in Iran are no longer in the global news, but serious human rights abuses related to the protests continue. That's the message from the Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Iran in its briefing to the Human Rights Council on Wednesday. Mission Chair Sarah Hosseini said that at least 26 people have been sentenced to death over the past 8 months in connection with the protests following the death in custody of Jina Mahsa Amini in September 2022, while many journalists, rights defenders and lawyers remain in detention. The rights investigators said that 7 men have already been executed following hasty proceedings marred by serious allegations of fair trial violations, including confessions extracted under torture. They also expressed concern over the reported use of facial recognition technologies to identify and arrest women and girls failing to comply with veiling laws, and the recent introduction of 2 draft bills aiming to further increase punishments for noncompliance. Speaking at the council, Iran refuted the allegations of a disproportionate response by security forces to the protests. The UN-appointed investigators called for an end to the crackdown, insisting that the people of Iran, including women and girls, have fundamental rights to equality, truth, justice, accountability, and reparations. The numbers of desperate African migrants arriving in Yemen by sea have soared this year, along with horrific violations at the hands of traffickers, the UN Migration Agency, IOM, said on Wednesday. IOM reported that halfway through 2023, more than 77,000 migrants have crossed the Gulf of Aden to Yemen, surpassing last year's figures. Most of them are fleeing the Horn of Africa with the hope of reaching the Gulf countries to find work. As human traffickers take control of their journey, migrants face exploitation and torture while perpetrators act with impunity. The agency said that insecurity, arrest campaigns, and forced transfers have left approximately 43,000 migrants stranded across Yemen. So far this year, IOM has helped over 5,600 migrants, most of them Ethiopians, to return home on voluntary flights. But the agency said the program and its life-saving health and protection services may soon grind to a halt if more funding for IOM's migrant response in Yemen is not urgently provided. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
I want all privately owned radios to be immediately impounded.
Yes,
ma'am. Log Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Well, there is such a place, Toto.
There must be. It's not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. It's far, far away. Behind the moon. Beyond the rain.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have an announcement.
I can no longer sit back and allow the conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Let's talk about
creeping like a communist. It's knocking at our doors, voraciously devouring the way things are today, savagely deflowering the
official story.
Radio Free Kansas.
Madness.
Radio Free Kansas.
Madness.
Why should you put your hands, G.I.?
Now, why don't you just take it easy? Please make me a drink of grain alcohol and rainwater and help yourself to whatever you'd like.
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Kansas!
Ear to the ground, voice in the air, worldwide.
Well, that's it, boys. I've been redeemed.
Radio Free Kansas.
Done washed away all my sins and transgressions.
You can listen in.
Yeah.
afternoon. What a strange weather pattern we're having here. It is, we probably may have another 4 or 5 days of temperatures in the 70s and 80s and never getting near 90 degrees. I guess the cold front that came through over the July 4th weekend. And behind it is this very large cool area. I don't know all the terms. But we've got some great weather ahead. If there's any sunlight to be had, good day if you're working outside on the road, on the highways, on the whatever you're doing. If you're working outside, this is a wonderful weather to work outside on your job. We've got a great, I think I told you yesterday, Second Hour has a new tax cast. It just came out a few days ago. And I think it came out Friday or Saturday. That's why I couldn't play it last Thursday. But today you've got the new one, and it's a good one. It really is. Tracking the billionaires, making sure that the wealthy put their income and their taxes out in public. That's a very interesting, innovative way, the Tax Justice Network, which produces the tax cast. Their mission statement, to try to bring the billionaires out into the public, know how much money they're making, where are they paying their taxes at, how much and when, put it on an index so the people all over the world will know what the wealthy are doing, where they're paying their taxes, how much they're making. I think that's what intrigues me about the tax cast and the Tax Justice Network. As I said earlier, of which you will have the latest podcast produced by Naomi Fowler. Now, we've got a full lineup here. The latest Democracy Now! Headlines are coming up. Law and Disorder will come up. And I think I'm going to come back very shortly. But other than that, let's roll with the headlines of Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it's seen no evidence to back claims by Ukraine's government that Russia's military has planted explosives at the Russian-held Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant in southern Ukraine. But the IAEA said it needs additional access to all six of Zaporizhzhia's reactor buildings to be sure. Both Moscow and Kyiv have accused each other of preparing to sabotage Europe's biggest nuclear plant. Overnight, a Russian missile attack on the western city of Lviv killed at least 4 people and injured 32 others. In eastern Ukraine, an airstrike triggered a massive fireball in the Russian-occupied city of Makivka. Russian officials said the strike hit a hospital, killing one person, injuring dozens. Ukraine's military says the video clearly shows it struck a Russian arms depot. In Minsk, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said earlier today the head of Russia's Wagner Group is not in Belarus and is instead in St. Petersburg, Russia. His surprise announcement came after Russian state TV broadcast images of police raids on Yevgeny Prigozhin's office in St. Petersburg and one of his mansions. Prigozhin has not been seen publicly since June 24th. President Lukashenko previously claimed Prigozhin had arrived in Belarus to live in exile as part of agreement that ended a mutiny by Wagner forces as they advanced to within 120 miles of Moscow. President Biden met with Swedish Prime Minister at the White House Wednesday, ahead of NATO's annual summit in Vilnius, Lithuania, next week.
Sweden is going to make our alliance stronger and has the same value set that we have in NATO. And really looking, anxiously looking forward for your membership.
Sweden's bid to join NATO has been blocked by the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who accuses Sweden of harboring members of the Kurdistan Workers Party, which is considered a terrorist group by Turkey. Turkey's opposition to Sweden joining NATO is now facing a further challenge as protests have broken out in a number of Muslim countries after two men staged a demonstration in which they tore up and burned a Quran outside a Stockholm mosque last week. This is an Iranian protester speaking Monday in front of the Swedish embassy in Tehran.
We declare that we are Muslims, and no country has the right to insult the Quran and cannot desecrate the Quran. And if they insult it, they will be given a strong response.
Pope Francis has also condemned the Quran burning. A federal judge in Louisiana has barred Biden administration officials from asking social media companies to remove misinformation from websites and apps. The ruling has broad ramifications for the ability of government officials to engage with the public through popular online forums. In a 155-page ruling handed down Tuesday, U.S. District Court Judge Terry Doty, a Trump appointee, issued an injunction against federal officials and agencies contacting sites like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, siding with Republican attorneys general who accused President Biden of trying to silence his critics. Judge Doty said several federal officials violated the First Amendment when they asked social media companies to take down misinformation about COVID-19, including false content about vaccines and the effectiveness of wearing masks. The judge also accused officials of suppressing free speech by battling claims that the 2020 presidential election was rigged. Legal observers say the sweeping ruling could end up enjoining hundreds of thousands of government employees from participating in online debate. In more technology news, Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, has officially launched a rival social media platform to Twitter, which has been struggling to retain users and advertisers since its purchase by billionaire Elon Musk last October. In the latest in a series of unpopular moves, Musk said over the weekend Twitter will begin limiting the number of tweets its users would be able to view per day unless they pay for premium service. Meanwhile, Canada's government says it's halted all advertising on Facebook and Instagram after Meta moved to restrict news content across Canada. Meta's move came after Canadian lawmakers approved the Online News Act, which will require tech companies to pay news outlets for posting their content on their platforms. Google's parent company, Alphabet, has also removed Canadian news articles from search results after calling the new law unworkable. President Biden has nominated Elliot Abrams to the bipartisan U.S. Advisory Commission on Public Diplomacy. Elliot Abrams was convicted in 1991 of lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair and later pardoned by then-President George H.W. Bush. He defended death squads in Guatemala and El Salvador in the 1980s as when he was serving as Assistant Secretary of State under President Ronald Reagan. Abrams dismissed reports that El Salvador's U.S.-trained military had massacred 1,000 civilians, including children, in the Salvadoran town of El Mazote in December 1981. He's also been linked to the 2002 attempted coup against Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and helped plan the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Under President Trump, Abrams served as special envoy to Iran and Venezuela. Abrams will need to be confirmed by the Senate to serve on the commission. The United Nations is warning rates of severe malnutrition in Ethiopia's Tigray have risen sharply, with nearly 9 million people needing food aid in the war-ravaged northern region. The World Food Program and the U.S. government, Ethiopia's two largest food donors, both halted deliveries to Tigray in April, saying the food was being diverted away from those in need. A Tigrayan official said hundreds have died, including children, since the aid was withdrawn, calling the situation extremely desperate. In Israel, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets of Tel Aviv Wednesday evening after the city's police commander announced he's resigning under pressure from senior Israeli government officials. Commander Ami Eshed said he would rather step aside than follow the demands of cabinet members who demanded a violent crackdown on protesters opposed to plans by the far-right government of Benjamin Netanyahu to gut Israel's judiciary. This is a protester speaking Wednesday.
I'm here today because I'm an Israeli who cares about democracy. I know that if the government decided to fire the head police officer of Tel Aviv only because he decided it's legal to protest, I think this is one step further for Israel to be a non-democratic state.
There were no mass protests in Israel over this week's two-day raid in Jenin, which killed 12 Palestinians, including four children, displaced thousands of residents, and razed homes to the ground. Back in the United States, unionized UPS drivers and warehouse workers are moving closer to a strike after contract negotiations broke down Wednesday. More than 340,000 UPS workers represented by the Teamsters are fighting for better wages and soaring cost of living increases in company profits. The current contract expires July 31st. In more labor news, thousands of Los Angeles hotel workers returned to work Wednesday after a three-day strike over the busy July 4th weekend. Workers say more stoppages are to be expected until a deal is reached on fair wages, health care, and pension benefits, and improved working conditions. And in a major victory for baristas, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Starbucks violated federal labor law when it fired workers at several Pittsburgh stores who were organizing their co-workers. Starbucks now has over 330 unionized coffee shops. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, I'll tell you, Democracy Now! Headlines are pretty good. It's like this is your lunchtime listening post. You know, back when I was a private detective, the name of my company was the People's Intelligence Service. Yeah, also known as PISS. So this is the way I breach that. I nowadays think you should get all the intelligence news to create your own analysis of where you think the world's going. I tell you, I'll be real quick because we've got a tight schedule here today. But that Elliot Abrams, you hear that name passing by there? That guy goes way back. That warmonger, that guy goes way back, all the way back to Central America in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan. Yeah, Elliot Abrams, he's a warmongering pig. I can't, well, Henry Kissinger is 100 years old now. God, he lived forever. Okay. Coming up tomorrow, I want to remind you, and then we're going to move on right into Law and Disorder. But coming up tomorrow, Free Thought Friday. Here's the promo. Great music.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with constitutional scholar and litigator Stephen Rohde on the disaster that's facing the First Amendment if they send Julian Assange back to the United States for trial and imprisonment.
Is there a glimmer of hope they won't extradite him? Stay tuned.
We'll also speak with author Asa Winstanley on his new book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, How the Israeli Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn.
Not only do they weaponize anti-Semitism in Great Britain, but we're also seeing the same tactics used against progressives here in the United States. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. Press freedom is under constant attack both in the U.S. and around the world. One of the highest profile battles on this front has been the one waged against award-winning Australian journalist, publisher, and founder of the nonprofit media organization WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. In 2010, in partnership with five newspapers, WikiLeaks published a series of documents and other media provided by U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning. including classified documents evidencing war crimes committed by U.S. forces during its war in Iraq. The U.S. has since unsealed indictments against Assange, charging him with a number of crimes that we'll be discussing today. Currently, Assange is languishing in a maximum security prison in London, struggling to maintain his physical health, his sanity, and his connections with loved ones. And in the meantime, an international movement of human rights and press freedom advocates are desperately fighting for his freedom and against his potential extradition to the United States. To bring us up to date on these efforts, we will be speaking with someone today who has been very active in the national campaign to free Julian Assange, Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a constitutional law scholar, author, and past chair of the ACLU of Southern California. He's also one of the founders of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, and he's a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Review of Books, Truth Dig, and LA Progressive. Stephen Rohde, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Maria and Michael. It's great to be back with you.
Well, as you know, May 3rd, 2023 marked the 30th anniversary of World Press Freedom Day, which the United Nations established to remind governments about the need to respect their commitment to the freedom of the press. But while the Biden administration proclaims the importance of press freedom globally, its hypocrisy in pursuing journalist and publisher Julian Assange is stunning. Is that how you see it?
Well, you bet. The Biden administration expressed outrage recently that Russia arrested a journalist, Evan Gershkovich, of the Wall Street Journal. Here's a U.S. citizen reporting from Moscow, practicing journalism. He's now incarcerated in Russia, facing espionage charges that could garner him over 20 years in prison. Now, of course, he should be released immediately. But the Biden administration continues to demand the extradition to the U.S. of an Australian national, Julian Assange, for obtaining and publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes. Both Gershkovich and Assange are journalists detained in a foreign country on espionage charges for doing what journalists do. Assange, as we tragically know, has been locked up in a maximum security prison in London for 4 years, while the Biden administration continues Trump's attempts to prosecute him under the notorious Espionage Act of 1917. If Assange is extradited and convicted, he could face 175 years in prison. And if all of that hypocrisy wasn't enough, in March at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Biden had the gall to declare that journalism is not a crime. If he really meant that, he would release Assange immediately.
Absolutely. Steve, please remind our listeners of the basis on which the Trump administration indicted Assange.
Well, no conversation about Assange should go farther than this without talking about the important work of WikiLeaks and Assange himself. It was in 2010, in collaboration with the New York Times, The Guardian, El Paz, Le Monde, and Der Spiegel, that WikiLeaks published 251,000 U.S. State Department cables. The New York Times said those documents revealed the unvarnished story of how the government makes its biggest decisions that cost the country most heavily in lives and money. In addition to being indicted for that, Assange was indicted for the revelation of the Iraq war logs, which were 400,000 field reports. But one of the key revelations was that there had been 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians and systematic rape and torture by U.S. forces. That's the kind of information he was revealing, which now he is charged with a crime. And then many of us have seen the deplorable 2007 collateral murder video, which shows a U.S. Army Apache helicopter targeting and killing 11 unarmed civilians. Two of those were Reuters news staff simply carrying cameras, not weapons, and they wounded two children. That video is actual evidence of the violations of the Geneva Convention and the U.S. Army Field Manual. Also, we know that in March of 2017, WikiLeaks revealed the Vault 7 document. That included the Year Zero documents, over 8,700, showing how the CIA has been hacking Apple iPhones, Google Androids, and Microsoft Windows, converting them into covert microphones, recording people around the world, including U.S. citizens. Those revelations, we believe, caused the CIA to become even more aggressive toward prosecuting Assange.
Wasn't the CIA and Mike Pompeo involved in discussions about kidnapping or even assassinating Assange?
Yes, I would cover that in the consequences, but we now have evidence that the CIA developed plans to kidnap and go as far as assassinating Assange. That's why we need a WikiLeaks, because you're not hearing about those revelations in the corporate media. It is shocking when you consider what an agency of the U.S. government was considering and planning, and it's why this case is so important.
Stephen Rohde, what is the current status of the U.S. effort to get Assange extradited from the U.K. to the U.S.? And what have been some of the biggest challenges?
Well, this is ultimately a tragic story, because in January of 2021, Assange actually scored an important victory. Now, here he is in Belmarsh Prison. The U.S. government is seeking to extradite him. In January of 2021, a U.K. judge actually rejected the U.S. application for extradition. That judge found that to extradite Assange to the United States into maximum security in the U.S. prison system would be oppressive and would risk his mental health and the potential of suicide. Now, the case could have ended there. This was the time of the Biden administration. Biden had a perfect reason to let the Trump indictment end there. But instead, Biden and Merrick Garland appealed that decision of the UK judge through the higher courts of England. And they were overturned by the British High Court in December of 2021 on the basis of, quote, assurances from the U.S. government that Assange would be treated nicely. It's the only way I can put it. They promised that when there's been all kinds of evidence of the kind of abuse in the American prison system. Well, untiringly, the Assange lawyers continued his appeal. It's been years, but tragically, this month, on June 6th, a single high court judge in London denied Assange's permission to pursue the rest of his appeal, which raised serious grounds, including the fact that the UK-US extradition treaty does not allow extradition for political offenses, which is precisely what the Assange prosecution is. Instead, in a very brief and cursory opinion, that one judge said that the grounds raised no arguable points, and he separately dismissed eight other grounds for appeal. In response to that ruling, Assange's wife, Stella, who's been doing such an extraordinary job across the world in urging her husband's innocence, she said that, and it did happen, that the appellate team filed the necessary papers to ask for a public hearing before two new judges at the High Court. Stella said she remained optimistic that he would eventually prevail. We're waiting now to see if those two judges will order a public hearing and give him another chance to appeal. If that fails, in the UK system, Assange can review the case in the European Court of Human Rights. And I do want to add here on a different level that two courageous lawyers, Margaret Kuntzler and Deborah Herbeck, have filed a civil suit in New York, in the Southern District of New York, because of the following fact. It turns out that every time they, as Assange's lawyers, visited him in the Ecuadorian embassy and as a routine security matter had their cell phones taken, the Spanish company that was providing so-called security for the Ecuadorian embassy was in fact recording their visits with Julian Assange, as well as other visitors to Julian, and were providing that information, the suit alleges, to the CIA as part of this overall effort to surveil and undermine Julian Assange's defense. Now, those are shocking revelations. They are fully documented in the case of Kuntzler versus Pompeo. Mike Pompeo is named as an individual defendant in that civil case. The government and Pompeo filed a motion to dismiss. Legal papers have been exchanged there in New York. Further papers are due in July, and there'll be a hearing in this case. This case is so important because it's a vehicle to reveal the improper conduct and prosecutorial misconduct that's been going on. It, frankly, on an entire separate ground, should lead to the dismissal of the criminal charges against Assange, as other evidence of the use of perjured testimony and other improprieties come to light. If this case was not such a travesty of judgment of justice, these revelations reveal that it's probably one of the grossest examples of improper prosecution by the U.S. government in recent memory.
Well, it was the prosecutorial misconduct that got the Daniel Ellsberg case thrown out. There's no difference between Ellsberg's case and this one. Steve Rohde, recently there's been a groundswell of support for Assange in the United States and around the world. Could you please remind our listeners about what's been happening lately?
I'm so glad you mentioned Daniel Ellsberg. He's been a hero of mine. I was privileged to work with him on the Assange Defense Committee, in which he is one of the three co-chairs. He is an example of an extraordinary, courageous individual, and most of your listeners know of his courage in connection with the Pentagon Papers case. But he was equally courageous in defending Julian Assange. It's worth taking a moment to realize that on the spectrum, Daniel Ellsberg was in the position of a leaker, much as the courageous Chelsea Manning was in this case. Julian Assange is a publisher on that side of the equation. But Julian Assange was in the position of the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case. This often gets lost in the demonization of Julian Assange. That's why they called it the New York Times problem, because under the Obama administration, his DOJ would not indict Assange, because how could they stop there without indicting the New York Times? fortunately, there is that groundswell of support for Julian Assange. Last November, the New York Times itself, along with all of those other newspapers that had made the early revelation, issued a joint open letter urging the U.S. government to dismiss the espionage charges against Assange for publishing those classified secrets. In that letter, these publications said that publishing is not a crime, and the U.S. government should end its prosecution of Julian Assange for publishing secrets. Then on the fourth anniversary of Assange's arrest, many representatives in Congress sent a letter to Merrick Garland seeking the dismissal of the Assange charges. That letter was signed by Rashida Tlaib, Jamal Bowman, Cori Bush, Greg Cesar, AOC, Ilhan Omar, and Ayaan Pressley. They urged the Department of Justice to affirm First Amendment protection. And they wrote as follows: press freedom, civil liberty, and human rights groups have been emphatic that the charges against Mr. Assange pose a grave and unprecedented threat to everyday constitutionally protected journalistic activity, and that a conviction would represent a landmark setback for the First Amendment. They echoed what the ACLU, Amnesty International, Reporters Without Borders, Human Rights Watch, Defending Rights and Dissent, and the Committee to Protect Journalists had said in a previous letter, that this sets an unprecedented example. Never before has a publisher on the publisher side of the equation have been charged for common journalistic practices under the espionage. The groundswell of support that you ask about is worldwide. Major governmental leaders in Australia, Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, Germany, UK have spoken out. 50 UK parliament members have, 75 Australian legislators have. The Council of Europe Commissioner for Human Rights has spoken out, and Rebecca Vinson at Reporters Without Borders said as long as the case against Assange continues, it will be a thorn in the side of the U.S. government and undermines U.S. efforts to defend media freedom globally. Well, that's the irreducible consequence of this. I don't care too much about the U.S. reputation. What I care about is reuniting Julian Assange with his wife and his two children and to strike a blow in favor of freedom of the press.
Oh, that is such a great point. For local listeners, are there upcoming events being organized in support of Julian Assange, actually locally or around the country?
Well, today, July 3rd, is Julian's birthday, and an extraordinary effort is being made to make the day a literally banner day in the effort to free Julian Assange. Through the Assange Defense Committee, over 150 banners, giant banners, saying free Assange, journalism is not a crime, have been distributed throughout the United States in 150 locations. Today, those banners will be displayed. We're hoping it will cause attention in the corporate mainstream media to draw attention to Assange's case. We hope everyone in every community will rally, will organize and demonstrate around those banners and those locations. In addition, today is Julian's birthday, and there is an entire effort to send either real or electronic birthday cards to Julian Assange. That can be done on a continuing basis, even if you're only hearing of it today on his birthday. In all of these efforts, everyone can go to AssangeDefense.org, and there is an individual, Vinny DiStefano, who is the National Organizing Director, and he has given permission for anyone to contact him at Vinny, V-I-N-N-I-E, at AssangeDefense.org to join in these national and international efforts. And then I hasten to add that everyone listening to this, if you've learned something today new or important about the Julian Assange case, the key is reaching Attorney General Merrick Garland and President Joe Biden. Please make phone calls today. Say that in the celebration of Julian Assange's birthday, the extradition should be dropped and Julian Assange should be freed. You can send emails and calls to the White House, to the Department of Justice. That's being done on a daily basis by organizers across the country. You have ample materials to look at AssangeDefense.org, which has an action page with sample letters and messages. I do believe and still cling to the idea that the Constitution does begin with the words, "We the people." And when you have such an egregious case as the one of Julian Assange, I think this is high time people spoke up for the sake of Julian Assange personally and for the sake of the broader challenge and defense of freedom of the press.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Maria Hall, and we're speaking with constitutional litigator and scholar Steve Rohde. Steve, could you please repeat that website for the Assange Defense Committee?
Yes, it's one of the easiest to remember, AssangeDefense.org. You can go there and see all of the information we've talked about today, updates on the case and the action page.
I just wanted to remark, Steve, that this case is really the most important First Amendment case in our lifetime. And after all, the First Amendment is what our form of democracy is based on. If we lose it, we're in a lot of trouble.
I couldn't agree more. I think in the annals, this will go down among the major free speech and press freedom cases of our lifetime. I hope everybody appreciates the importance of that, but instead of treating it as a curiosity and moving on today in their busy lives.
Yeah, well, Michael Ratner, one of the founders of Law and Disorder, was Assange's first American lawyer. He represented Julian until the day he died 7 years ago.
You're right, and I went to law school with Michael. I have the deepest respect for his legacy, and I hope everybody will take into consideration that he is the kind of person that fought for press freedom, for civil rights and human rights, and in his name and in the name of other heroes like him, including Daniel Ellsberg, Americans should be rising up and calling for the release of Julian Assange.
Well, Stephen Rohde, we certainly appreciate your work as well. And please let listeners know where they can read more of your writings about Assange and other important civil and human rights topics.
Well, thank you. Most of my work is collected at the Los Angeles Review of Books website, LARB. I actively now write for Truth Dig and LA Progressive and other publications. Those are available on the web. I personally have made this a commitment. I'm going to continue to do this work, and I'm proud of you guys for giving it so much attention.
Steve Rohde, before we let you go, unfortunately we've run out of our allotted time, but before we let you go, I think that most profoundly this case represents the trashing of the rule of law. Wouldn't you agree?
We're seeing so many signs of that. Only last week, the conservative Supreme Court dismantled affirmative action. They threw a bone to the First Amendment in one case this term. But there is such a judicial hypocrisy in this field of paying lip service to free speech, paying lip service to freedom of the press, and instead in the actual work of the CIA, of the Department of so-called Justice, we see this kind of undermining. We can all be appalled at the insurrection on January 6th and the illegality of ex-President Trump and his enablers. But so long as official U.S. government policy and activism is to prosecute and persecute an individual like Julian Assange, we can not rest in any sense that the U.S. is a beacon of liberty and the rule of law. We have much to be held accountable for. What should be happening is those who committed war crimes in the collateral murder video and throughout the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, those are the people that should be in the dock. Those are the people that should be criminally charged. And yet, decade after decade, government officials that have openly and blatantly violated the law, they walk scot-free, while a courageous individual like Julian Assange sits in jail.
Well, thank you so much, Steve Rohde. We're all sitting on pins and needles knowing that Assange could be extradited to the United States for trial any minute now, and we'll be in touch with you on this. Thanks again for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you both very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Has written an important book called Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, How the Israeli Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn. The book has lessons for those of us working for social justice here in the USA. The main lesson is, don't placate them. Corbyn and the Socialists and the Labour Party in England were crushed by the mounting of a massive campaign cynically labeling Corbyn as an anti-Semite. It was a preposterous charge, but it stuck. The neoliberal Labour Party changed after the influx of several hundred thousands of young people and elected longtime socialist activist Jeremy Corbyn as its leader in 2015. Despite the huge campaign against him, led by the Israeli lobby, Corbyn was almost elected as the prime minister in 2017. Over the years, socialist Corbyn became popular, especially among hundreds of thousands of young people who had recently joined the Labour Party. He got his start in the trade union movement. He spoke out against racism and fascism and for immigrant rights. He opposed privatization cuts and austerity. He campaigned against wars and military occupations. Asa Winstanley writes that probably more than anything else, Corbyn was known among activists for his involvement in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. The possibility of Corbyn being elected terrified the right and its allies. The Israeli lobby's campaign against Corbyn got help from British intelligence, the entire British media, the right wing in England, the right wing of the Labour Party, and even the CIA. The most powerful, well-heeled part of the American pro-Israeli lobby is APAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. Justice Democrats wrote that it is a sinister right-wing group. They supported Donald Trump, endorsed 106 insurrection Republicans, and spent millions to defeat progressives, targeting and trying to intimidate black and brown women candidates across the country, threatening to spend against them if they even slightly criticized Israel's far-right apartheid policies. They conflate criticism of Israel's apartheid state with anti-Semitism. Today we speak with Asa Winstanley. He's an investigative journalist and author who writes primarily about Palestine and the Israeli lobby. He lives in London. He's an associate editor with the Electronic Intifada, the world's leading Palestinian news site in the English language. Asa Winstanley, welcome to Law and Disorder. I just want to say that your book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, How the Israeli Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn, is a great book, a real necessity, and it reads like a thriller. It's a page-turner. So congratulations for producing Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, a very fine book.
Well, thanks a lot for that. Appreciate it. It's great to be with you.
Asa, in 2015, socialist anti-racist Jeremy Corbyn became the leader of the Labour Party in England. What was his political history, and how and why did he get support, and from whom?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn is somebody who's been in the Labour Party for many decades, really all his life, and he has always been on the left of the Labour Party. You know, the mainstream British media describe him as the far left, but that's not really what he is. He's really a socialist, a social democrat. You know, he's very strongly in favour of democracy and peace. He's somebody who has been involved in the anti-war movement for many, many decades. He's somebody who has been involved in solidarity movements all around the world, justice movements, anti-racist movements. And he's certainly someone who's on the left of the Labour Party, and he's someone who's involved in popular movements. And this is the thing, he is an MP, but he was really on the back benches of the Labour Party for many years before he became the leader. And he was really someone who was involved in the grassroots of campaigning rather than the leadership of his party. He was, for really most of his career, opposed to the leadership of his party, especially during the Tony Blair years, when Tony Blair, the former Labour Prime Minister and his party leader, was taking Britain into the illegal and destructive and violent occupation of Iraq with George Bush.
Well, thank you for that. And that segues into a question I have. How was Jeremy Corbyn different from the neoliberal Labour Party under Tony Blair that supported the Iraq War?
Yeah, he was night and day different. He was the complete opposite, essentially. Tony Blair, I mean, this is something I mentioned in the book, a really interesting historical fact is that Margaret Thatcher, who was really Britain's equivalent to Ronald Reagan, you know, she ushered in the neoliberal era of privatization and really dismantling the welfare state of Britain and selling off nationalized industries and selling off the railways and so forth. A really interesting historical fact is that Margaret Thatcher once said that her greatest achievement was Tony Blair and New Labour, because Tony Blair and New Labour took the Labour Party away from its roots of being a socialist party and continuing the legacy of Margaret Thatcher and neoliberalism. Jeremy Corbyn represented the polar opposite of that. He was somebody who campaigned for renationalization of industries. You know, he wanted, when he first ran for the leadership of the Labour Party in 2015, he proposed policies like renationalizing the railways. So Britain's railways, they used to be just one national company owned by the government. Well, now, because of the neoliberal era, they're all owned by corporations and run for profit for the benefit of shareholders. And there's this kind of chaos of all these different companies running different lines. And that's incredibly unpopular throughout the whole country, throughout all voters, really. I mean, even Conservative Party voters say they want the railways to be renationalized. That was something Corbyn proposed. So it was very moderate policies that he was proposing. But more than anything else, Jeremy Corbyn was a peace movement activist. So I mentioned before about how Tony Blair led the country into the war in Iraq. At the same time as that was happening, Jeremy Corbyn was with us. He was with us on the streets marching against the war, and he was, you know, leading rallies and giving speeches against the war. I think this really kind of anti-imperialist part of his politics, and especially his support for the Palestine Solidarity Movement, made him a real target of all kinds of vested interests in trying to stop him becoming prime minister.
Asa Winstanley, as a socialist head of the Labour Party, he almost became the prime minister in 2017, losing narrowly. Why was he defeated? Please talk about the campaign that called him an anti-Semite. After all, he himself stated that he'd been an anti-racist his entire life. Did his detractors conflate opposition to Israeli government policies with respect to Palestinians with anti-Semitism?
Well, on the latter point, yeah, absolutely they did. And this is really the focus of my book. He came very, like, as you said, he became very, very close to becoming prime minister in 2017. So the general election in 2017 was an election that was called earlier than it was due to be held, because the ruling Conservative Party was, you know, very confident at the time. You know, Jeremy Corbyn was seen as an unpopular candidate, and so the mainstream wisdom had it. And the ruling Prime Minister, Theresa May at the time, she had, because of Britain's really undemocratic electoral system, she'd never won an election, so she wanted her own electoral mandate, and her advisors told her that, you know, because Jeremy Corbyn's unpopular and he's this far-left extremist and so on and so forth, all this kind of nonsense they used to portray him as, they said, you should go for an election so you can increase your majority, because they had a very narrow majority in Parliament and she couldn't get much of her agenda done. So they went for this election. But then what happened was really unexpected, was that when the general public in Britain actually saw Jeremy Corbyn's policies put in front of the electorate in a general election campaign, when they saw what he actually stood for, the more they saw it and saw beyond these scare story media headlines, the more they liked it. They liked the fact that he was anti-war. They liked the fact that he said, you know, we need to move beyond this era of Britain sending troops overseas to kill and be killed, and we need to find peaceful solutions. They liked his policies of having just general forms of, you know, just dignity for normal working people, basically. Very moderate reforms in the country, just things like ending homelessness and free school meals for children and so forth. The more they saw that, the more people liked it. And he came, in the end, he came very, very close. He came within a few thousand votes of actually winning. And it was seen as a really stunning, although it wasn't an outright victory, he didn't win the election overall. He reduced Theresa May's majority in Parliament. Like, she, the Prime Minister, the Conservative Prime Minister, she was expecting to increase a majority, but the opposite happened. And that really led to her political downfall, and she was replaced soon after with another Conservative Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. Really, what happened was, the reason why Jeremy Corbyn didn't win that election overall, although he made advances, was that he was sabotaged internally from within his own party. So although he had the backing of his own, he had the backing of the people, he had the backing of the mass movement, he had the backing of the grassroots, the membership of the Labour Party, which was hundreds of thousands of people. It was more than 500,000 at the height of Corbyn's popularity. He had that backing, but the establishment within the party, the majority of Labour MPs, about three quarters of Labour MPs, opposed him actively and openly. Some of them just were very openly campaigning against him, almost to lose. They were campaigning almost to lose their own seats. And some of them did lose their own seats as a result. And the party establishment as well, the party bureaucracy, undermined him. They worked against their own party. These paid workers for the party, they worked against Jeremy Corbyn because they wanted to see him lose. They didn't want to have a socialist prime minister. And so because of all that internal sabotage within the party and the fact that Corbyn never had full control of the bureaucracy, it was very detrimental, you know, and he could have won if it wasn't for that. Certainly in 2017, he could have become prime minister.
Asa Winstanley, can you talk about what role fear played in getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn and his left supporters who were building a genuine socialist Labour Party? For example, in your book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, you discuss McCarthyism and Arthur Miller's play The Crucible about the witch hunt in colonial America and the witch hunt in 1950s against communism and socialism. Talk about this, please.
there was all kinds of smear campaigns thrown up against Jeremy Corbyn. So the British media really sort of excelled itself in its just relentless propaganda against maintaining the status quo, essentially. What they did was they basically threw anything at him. There was all kinds of ridiculous scare stories, like there was this, the security services, Britain's spy agencies, basically started leaking like mad to the press, and at one point they claimed that Jeremy Corbyn was, during the Cold War, was a spy for the communist government of Czechoslovakia, which was completely untrue, but nonetheless, it was headlines for a short while. Corbyn, to his credit, sued over that. He sued for libel over that and actually won and donated the winnings to charity. And there was just lots of other stuff like that. But the most successful smear campaign of all was this idea that he was anti-Semitic, or at least that the people around him were anti-Semitic, and that the Labour Party had become this kind of wretched hive of scum and villainy, and that it was full of all these terrible left-wing anti-Semites. Well, 99.99 cases out of 100, that was just completely untrue. And what was actually being called quote-unquote anti-Semitic was actually opposition to Israel, opposition to Zionism, and opposition to the settler colonial project that is occupying Palestine. Sometimes in crude terms, for sure, like people sometimes say things that are over the top and maybe a bit crass, but, in most cases, what was being said was not really anti-Semitic, and what was attacked in Jeremy Corbyn and in the pro-Corbyn movement was actually support for Palestinian human rights, support for Palestinian equality, and just generally left-wing politics as well. It's become a very powerful weapon in the right-wing arsenal, in the world in general now, we can say, and a lot of it is down to what has happened in Britain over the last 8 years or so. And as you said, yes, there's a great amount of fear. At the height of it in the Labour Party, there was people being kicked out of the Labour Party constantly. People were being suspended. They were being disciplined by internal party bureaucrats. They were being kicked out, and it started with really high profile supporters of Corbyn. The former mayor of London, the former Labour mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, who was really a stalwart of anti-racist campaigns in the 70s and especially the 80s, at a time when supporting black people and supporting anti-racist campaigns wasn't very popular, certainly not in the mainstream media, which was just very openly racist a lot of the time in the 80s. At those times, Ken Livingstone was supporting, equality for black and brown people, and he was supporting gay rights at a time when it was actually quite unpopular in the country. Fast forward to 2016, and he's being smeared and attacked as this terrible anti-Semite within the Labour Party. And he was suspended from the Labour Party and eventually forced to leave the Labour Party. And it was just a really terrible assault on the most high-profile supporter of Jeremy Corbyn. There was then an immense amount of fear, because it meant that what Ken Livingstone had said about the reality of the history of the collusion of the German Zionist movement in the 1930s with the Nazis, the German Nazis, the historical facts, it meant that, that was became basically verboten, like you weren't allowed to say that in any kind of public forum. And it extended into wider society, and there really is an immense amount of fear that is really still going.
This is Attorney Michael Smith at Law and Disorder. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Maria Hall. We're speaking with Asa Winstanley in London. He has just had published his excellent book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, How the Israeli Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn. You can get it at orbooks.com. What was and what is the relationship between the Israeli lobby in England, and I would also say in the United States, but what was the relationship between the Israeli lobby in England and the Israeli government?
Yeah, this is a really good question, because quite often the Israel lobby, pro-Israel groups in Britain and America and all around the world, they just sort of portray themselves as, oh, we're just normal sort of grassroots supporters and campaigners of Israel, for Israel. More insidiously, they actually portray themselves as Jewish community groups, as representatives of the entire Jewish community, as if all Jews support Israel and Zionism, which, as we know, is completely untrue. But the reality is that pro-Israel groups, the lobby, if you will, the pro-Israel lobby, works hand in glove with the state of Israel. It's been very well documented and proven that there is a high degree of coordination that goes on with a lot of these groups and the actual state of Israel itself, but it's kept quite secretive. You know, it's kept behind closed doors. I mean, if you know what to look for, it's quite clear to see. I mean, you can just take one recent example, which, you know, falls outside of the time period of my book because it happened, I think, soon after it was published. Or anyway, the most recent example of the Israel lobby campaign against Roger Waters, the founder of Pink Floyd and still a very popular touring musician who uses his massive platform to support all kinds of campaigns for justice and equality and human rights, and especially the Palestinian people. He uses his platform to support Palestinian people. Well, he is a massive campaign for the Israel lobby. Like, he's a massive target of the Israel lobby. And in the most recent campaign by the Israel lobby against Roger Waters, where they were trying to get his dates for his tour in Europe cancelled, like literally cancelled, he wouldn't be allowed to play his music in Germany and London. They came close to succeeding in Germany. They had less success in London. But in all cases, actually, Roger Waters fought back and he won. What was being said about Roger Waters was that he was an anti-Semite. Well, it was completely untrue. But it didn't stop them sort of spewing these smears and lies against him. And you could see the way it went. I mean, just even on social media, you could see it was quite openly done, actually, in this case. What happened was that Israeli states... social media accounts, their official social media accounts, started tweeting all these lies against Roger Waters, saying that he was a Nazi on stage and all these kinds of things, and that there was a pig with the Star of David at his concert in Germany and all this kind of thing. But then what happened was, literally within hours and the next day or two, the pro-Israel lobby group started parroting exactly the same pictures, exactly the same attack lines. And you could see it happening, especially in Britain, because that's where Roger Waters' tour was happening next. And they were trying to get momentum going for Roger Waters' tour in Britain to be cancelled. It didn't work out for them, thankfully. But you could see these pro-Israel groups, like the Board of Deputies of British Jews, a very, very active pro-Israel group, which admits in its internal documents that it works closely with the embassy of the State of Israel in the UK, the Israeli military spokesperson, and even Israel's secretive Ministry of Strategic Affairs. They parroted the lines of the Israeli government very soon after against Roger Waters, and so did other pro-Israel groups. So that's just one example. You know, the pro-Israel lobby works in very close coordination with the Israeli state. It's not necessarily as simple as every single thing these pro-Israel groups is directed by the Israeli government. No, it's a bit more complicated than that, but nonetheless, it is a fact. There is direction that happens, and it literally, as Roger Waters actually said on stage, it literally does come from Tel Aviv, a lot of it. So, you know, it is a fact. The coordination happens, and Al Jazeera in its undercover investigations also gave a lot of evidence of that.
Asa Winstanley, you've written in your book, speaking of your book, Weaponizing Antisemitism, How the Israeli Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn, that he was defeated by the right wing inside the Labour Party, the entire media, and the conservatives in Great Britain, and all with the help of British intelligence and even the CIA. Please talk about this.
Yeah, this is really interesting, and I opened my book with it because I wanted to contextualize it a bit more. My book, it's my area of expertise, and it was the area of my focus was to focus on the Israel lobby aspect of it. But, you know, as you said, there was an ad hoc unity of interest between all these forces of the status quo that wanted to oppose Jeremy Corbyn. And we saw that there was a quite open involvement of the British forces, British security services, in other words, British spies, MI5 and MI6, who are Britain's equivalent of the FBI and the CIA, quite openly briefing journalists. my friend Matt Kennard, a really good investigative journalist for an outlet called Declassified UK, he did a good story on this a few years ago while Corbyn was still running for Prime Minister in 2019. And he did an analysis of the media coverage of Jeremy Corbyn, and he found 34 open examples where British papers and media outlets had openly sourced their attack stories, their information, from British intelligence and British military sources. So in the newspapers it would say, according to a security source, which means a British spy, essentially. So, you know, the spies obviously were not named and not given personal names, but they came from security, intelligence and military sources. And all of these stories, these 34 stories, were portraying Jeremy Corbyn as a threat to national security in one way or another. So this was what was being done openly. And so we can only imagine what they were doing privately, secretly, covertly, behind the scenes to target people who want change, who want radical change in public life and want the government to take a different direction. We know that the British Security Service is very similar to the FBI and the CIA, acts to subvert that kind of change.
Asa Winstanley, supporters of Israel in the U.S. and in England use the same tactics. What lessons can we learn from Jeremy Corbyn's defeat? You're critical of him for placating the Israeli lobby for its lies and manufacturing a crisis. Please talk about this.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, look, I like Jeremy Corbyn. There's no doubt about it. Like, he's a nice guy, personally. I did interview him once in 2015. And I think, unlike most politicians in Britain and in America, and probably most politicians in general in the West, he actually has the right political instincts most of the time. You know, he's against war. He's for equality, human rights. He's against racism. And, you know, he wants just a decent standard of living for most people. But at the same time, I think it's important to face up to the lessons of when, you know, the movement gets things wrong. And I think Jeremy Corbyn was the victim of a lot of bad advice, where he heard that, oh, you know, if we just concede to some of this and kind of sweep it under the rug, we can kind of move on. You know, if we just say, okay, yes, there has been some anti-Semitism, and we're sorry for that, and I oppose anti-Semitism, then we can just move on and get on with our program. And this in particular was kind of the line that his colleague John McDonnell, I think, was saying a lot of the time, and he was saying that quite publicly. And we just saw that this didn't work. You know, the line that was always put out was, I oppose anti-Semitism, I oppose anti-Semitism, I oppose anti-Semitism. This was what Jeremy Corbyn was saying all the time. Now, who could disagree with that? Of course, we all oppose prejudice against Jewish people and discrimination and the sort of stereotyping of Jewish people in a essentially racist fashion. Who could disagree with that? But the problem is, when you say, if that's your line all the time, that if you just say, I'm against anti-Semitism, this is what you kept saying over the years, you're then giving the impression to the wider electorate, to the movement within the Labour Party, that maybe there is a bit of, you know, no smoke without fire kind of thing. And so it was a problem. And when you get these kind of false weaponized allegations of anti-Semitism, you have to stand up to them. You have to be able to say openly and clearly, no, this isn't true. This is a smear. Yes, of course, we all oppose anti-Semitism, but nonetheless, in this case, this is a false allegation of anti-Semitism that is being deployed against me because I am a supporter of Palestinian human rights. And that's what people like Ken Livingston did, and an MP, a left-wing MP, Chris Williamson, and they were basically chased out of the party because they did do that. And Jeremy Corbyn, unfortunately, never did that. And ultimately, that helped lead to his defeat. And so I think the lesson to be learned is that these kinds of smear campaigns, you can't sweep them under the rug. You can't just say, oh, okay, well, you know, if we just sort of concede to a few demands, it will go away. It won't. You know, the Israel lobby is ruthless. The state of Israel is very ruthless to its enemies. And you can see how it treats Palestinians. It treats all its perceived enemies in a very similarly ruthless fashion. It never goes away. These false anti-Semitism, weaponized anti-Semitism allegations is something that Israel's been doing for decades. And so they're never going to stop it. You can't just sweep it under the rug. It has to be opposed and defeated. And I think that's the lesson that needs to be learned.
Well, thank you so much, Asa Winstanley. Thank you for writing your excellent book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism. You can get it at orbooks.com. The astute editor at OR Books, Colin Robinson, gave it that intelligent title. We're grateful to him. We're grateful for you, Asa. And before we let you go, in a nutshell, how can people follow your work?
Yes, well, thank you for the kind words about my book. It's really appreciated. You know, I was working on it for quite a few years, and I am a reporter for the Electronic Intifada, and you can follow all my work by subscribing to my Substack, which is on asawinstanley.substack.com. There's free and paid options, and I put out all my work there, and there's original work on there as well as the republications for my EI and my appearances in media outlets such as yourself.
Thank you again, Asa Winstanley, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour, every Saturday, 12 p.m., where we broadcast the news that you won't find on cable. Ever wonder what Gen Z is up to? Have you heard of Generation U? Ever wonder why the old geezers are excited that something's going on since their days of living underground and avoiding the Vietnam draft? We cover these topics on the Abolitionist Hour, and we kind of give you updates on the front, whether it's Atlanta, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City. We'll keep you updated on news and information on the state of dismal prison conditions and why the Jackson County Jail is not just a stockade. It's a phone company. So join us at the Abolitionist Hour, only on Blog Talk Radio, 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. We'll see you there.
And from the plains of Royal Mead, drunk men came hurrying through, while Britannia's Huns with her long-range guns came in through the foggy
back to the glen I rode again, and my heart with grief was sore. For I parted them with valiant whom I never shall see more.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. You can subscribe to the TaxCast there, or you can email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Get in touch and tell me what you think of the show. Okay, on the TaxCast. Foiled pet and private jet. We can't afford the rich, but there's plenty we can do about it. So, come fly with us. Yeah, I know it's cheesy.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
Whether you're pretty wealthy, even wealthier, or super stonkingly rich, if you choose it, there's no long waits at airport check-ins for you, and no need to expose yourself to diseases by mixing with the public. Seriously, monkeypox and COVID are two of the reported reasons private aviation's booming. And apparently, it's tough in the private jet business. as this entrepreneur explains. I hope you're taking notes.
About a year ago, in the beginning of 2022, I started a private jet charter broker company with a partner, and here's the reasons why you should not start this business. First off, the customer is very, very specific and very, very hard to market to. The person you're going after that's going to spend $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 on a private jet flight for a single charter is somebody that makes between $5 and $10 million a year or more. Now, how do you acquire these customers? If you have a very good organic network and you know a lot of high net worth individuals that charter jets specifically, then this may be a business model for you. But for myself, even knowing a lot of people that make $1 million a year, $2, $3 million a year, even those people in my network often do not travel via private jet. It's simply not worth the cost. If you're making $100,000 a month net or even gross, whatever it may be, $20,000 on a trip is quite a lot of money. And it really just doesn't make sense if you can fly first class or whatever. So the customer is very, very hard to go after. My business as a private jet charter broker is over. It's a failure for me.
Oh dear. So this guy didn't own any private jets himself. What he was doing was connecting up wealthy people to private jet operators for a fee. And he was mainly using Google Ads to get his leads. In that YouTube video, he says he was investing about $1,714 to get enough clients who eventually paid up for private jet flights, and he made an average of $1,837 per flight. You can see why he gave it up. But a few steps up from that, there are, of course, big multi-million dollar companies that own, lease and operate entire fleets of private jets. The number of private jets globally has gone up 133% in the last 20 years. But there are some challenges to their business model too. Listen to this conversation among colleagues in this sector. This is a video made by one of the world's largest private jet companies, Lux Aviation.
Do you get many clients asking for sustainable fuel?
Well, I think we need to work on that. As an industry, I think we do a lot. Starting to look at sustainable aviation fuel to run some of the aeroplanes. We're starting to look at more efficient engines. And I think we can work, you know, within our parameters. We've got to do as much as we can to convince people that we're part of the overall transport plan. I think going forward, you know, one of our questions is the perception of business aviation. It's going to be a challenge for us.
And it's not just public perceptions they're worried about.
You only have to look to the US and see, you know, there are several people who are tracking every aviation flight. You'll see Bernard Arnault has just sold his aircraft based on the tracking and the sort of sustainability pressure. Some of the large pharmaceutical companies have decided to sell up their fleets as well. I think we'd be kidding ourselves to think that they are no longer flying privately. I think they're probably going to less trackable methods.
Yeah, one way to do that is transferring ownership of your jet to a trust so we don't know who owns it. So tracking is of limited use. Bernard Arnault, by the way, is the second richest man in the world, apparently. Actually, he's just been told he can't dock his yacht in Naples because it's too big. It's got a glass-bottomed swimming pool and outdoor cinema. He's very disappointed, apparently. But back to flying. Who is the typical private jet owner? Well, they're overwhelmingly male, over 50, and they're in banking, finance, and real estate. They represent 0.0008% of the global population. Their median net worth is $190 million. They don't bother with chartering a private jet from a company. They buy their own. And unlike some wealthy people, this guy is not private about it.
Big day. It's a huge day. I'm shaking. That's how huge a day it is.
Tell everyone.
I am going to get to see my new jet today for the very first time. You're going to see it with me for the very first time. It is ridiculously exciting. And I don't know what to do with myself. So.
Bear in mind, a private plane will cost you millions. Aviation experts say to justify buying your own jet, you'd need to be burning through 350 to 400 hours of flight time a year.
And here we go.
Get out of here.
How about this?
Mate, that is gorgeous.
Is that wicked?
Wait till you see inside it. I am so ridiculously excited.
Oh my god.
All right, let's do it.
For Freighter 600.
Yeah. Oh my god. I'm going in.
All yours.
Oh my god, this is wicked. It's exactly the way it's supposed to be. The only one in the world.
The only one in the world.
And this guy's purchase is relative small fry. Here's Kim Kardashian checking out her new jet.
I wanted it to feel like an extension of me and an extension of my home.
I had a bathroom put in the front, a bathroom in the back. Every seat has its own phone charger. The best, most exciting part of the plane is it's all cashmere. Cashmere ceilings, pillows, headrests. I feel like I'm doing an MTV crib for planes. Like, oh, what a dream.
A cashmere-lined plane interior. Never a clearer example of why we need wealth taxes. And on the subject of taxes, Donald Trump's 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, remember that, allowed jet owners to write off the cost of a new plane used for business purposes in its first year. His most recent plane cost him a reported $100 million, and it's got gold plating everywhere. There's no doubt governments need to implement a whole range of wealth taxes, urgently. And check this out, from jets to pets.
Hi guys!
Hi guys!
Hi everyone!
Hello little angels!
Parrish designed the doggy mansion as a copy of her own home.
So who's who? Point out which dog's which.
Prada. Dolce.
That's
her daughter.
Oh,
that's Marilyn Monroe.
Marilyn.
And this is Harajuku bitch.
Look at this jumper. Check this out. You are one trendy doggy, aren't you? You're so cool. You're so cool and trendy.
That's ridiculous.
You're so adorable. And this house. I mean, I'd happily live in there.
You have a little look.
Upstairs.
Yeah, furniture and chandelier.
You've got a mezzanine level and a sofa.
Haven't you?
We have
a little closet.
You've got a closet.
And
it's actually got clothes in.
Yeah. And I just designed it sort of like my house. We put like moldings and put the chandelier and the heater and air conditioning.
We've got air conditioning. This is just genius.
I love animals. They're very spoiled.
Rightly so, your little princesses.
Yeah, really. Spoiled pets like these seem to have as many needs as their private jet owners have. Back to that Lux Aviation video.
Some of the sort of maybe special things you might want. Are you travelling with pets? Are you going to be having your dogs? Do you want them loose in the cabin? We have a regular flyer who's a budgie that comes in his cage, and he occasionally brings his lovebird mate with him. So there's a lot of little sort of small questions that might be the kind of icing on the cake to ensure that you get the aircraft that makes it the most kind of pleasurable and easy experience for you.
Budgies and their love mates, of course. Anyway, Lux Aviation's CEO really caught the world's attention at the recent Financial Times Business of Luxury conference in Monte Carlo, Monaco. The guest of honour was His Serene Highness Prince Albert II of Monaco. Lux Aviation was a gold sponsor for the conference, so maximum PR potential to pitch this private jet company. And that's just what the CEO of Lux Aviation did. He used an unusual and eye-catching angle.
Come on. Now, what you do not know, but I think it's important to put this in perspective, a cat is responsible for approximately 700 kilos of CO2 every year. So three cats is one passenger.
Pardon, what? Someone from the company clarified afterwards that he meant to say dogs, not cats. What he's saying is that having three dogs is as bad for putting out carbon dioxide as a year's private jet flying for one person. It's not. The private jet industry does have an image problem. It's got a moral problem, and it knows it. And it's not just the general public. Here's a millionaire telling the BBC why he's getting rid of his jet.
The 10 times the amount of carbon input into the environment versus commercial travel, that did it. It threw me over the edge. It's like I'm taking up 10 seats in a 737 when I'm flying instead of the one that I do. It just struck me how incredibly selfish.
Well, yeah. According to estimates, just 1% of people are responsible for about half of all aviation carbon emissions. Going back to that bizarre dog statistic from the CEO of Lux Aviation, he got that from a book on carbon footprints by Professor Mike Berners-Lee. And here's the professor himself talking to the BBC.
I was pretty disappointed to see my book used as a justification for actually for luxury private jets, which is what Lux Aviation were using it for. In my book, I do talk about the carbon footprint of an average dog being 700 kilograms per year, rough estimate. And Lux Aviation estimated that I think it's a single short flight on one of their smaller jets would be 2.1 tons. So that does work out at three dogs per single one-way flight. Those numbers from Lux Aviation look suspiciously low to me. They don't tally with sums that I've done elsewhere. If you took five return short-haul flights on a private jet in a year, that would be like having 60 dogs.
It starts to get mind-boggling when you try calculating dog per long-haul flight. Apparently, it does depend on what you feed the dogs, the size of them, and all sorts of other stuff, but that's not for this podcast. Anyway, the professor is very clear.
Cutting out private jets, we absolutely should reduce them by a long way. Private jets, they're something like 10 times more carbon intensive than normal commercial flying. All of us need to ask, any time we think about taking an aeroplane, we have to understand that's a high carbon thing to do. We have to ask ourselves, can we justify it? And if you're taking a private jet, you have to ask yourself 10 times as hard.
Yeah, I know. It's really the system and governance we need to focus on. And tax has a huge role to play in that. By the way, the professor's not impressed by all the world summits we've had, the so-called COPs, to tackle carbon emissions and climate crisis.
I think we have to recognise that we've now had 27, that's 27 COPs, to try and cut the world's carbon footprint. And if you look at the global carbon curve, it's still going up at the global level. It's still going up exactly as if humans had never noticed that climate change might be an issue. So we have to recognise the COPs are absolutely not doing it for us.
Taxes really are a superpower for tackling the climate and inequality crisis. At the Tax Justice Network, we'll be covering all that in more detail soon. I'm putting some further reading on that in the show notes, so look out for that. But back to the world of the super wealthy and Lux Aviation, the private jet company. That company's CEO is interesting because he recently played a key role in protecting the secrecy of the wealthy and powerful. If we rewind a good few years, there was a breakthrough in Europe when it came to identifying the real flesh and blood owners of companies. After all the leaks and scandals like the Panama Papers exposing the dangers of financial secrecy, the fourth European anti-money laundering directive came along, implementing beneficial ownership registers, or UBO registers, in the EU. Yes, the very same registers the Tax Justice Network was laughed at for proposing. We were told they'd never happen.
However, many states made this only accessible to law enforcement authorities, which made it not very effective. The fifth directive then went further and stipulated that they must be publicly accessible, although even with this, many countries dragged their feet in terms of creating them, and they weren't necessarily easy to access or even free.
This is business advisory firm Dun & Bradstreet.
Luxembourg was one of the first to introduce one, and it did make it completely free to access. However, a couple of individuals then challenged the Luxembourg business registers, saying that their ownership interests would open them up to disproportionate risks and also infringe their right to private life.
One of these individuals was the CEO of Lux Aviation. The case ended up in the European Court of Justice, which ruled in his favour. That ruling rolled back one of the most powerful measures against financial secrecy of the past decade, taking away the requirement for EU nations to have a public beneficial ownership register. It meant European governments who wanted to could return to the dark ages of dirty money. At the time of recording, only a third of member states kept their registers public after the ruling. You won't be surprised to learn that the ones that ended public access tend to be countries that were already offering higher levels of financial secrecy. All this just as governments were showing off about seizing the assets of Russian oligarchs. Well, good luck with that. Back to Dun and Bradstreet.
So onto the ruling itself. Essentially, it boils down to weighing up the objectives, i.e. combating financial crime and preventing money laundering, versus the interference with Articles 7 and 8 of the EU Charter in respect to the right to personal and family life and the protection of personal data. Some of the concerns that came out of the ruling suggest that it is not suitably clear that public access actually advances the objective. The court, however, did point out that Articles 7 and 8 are not absolute rights, so they do not simply override everything, but they must be shown that the level of interference is proportionate to the objective.
Yeah, all rights are subject to reasonable restrictions that also serve society. And financial secrecy doesn't just offer criminal opportunities to people, potentially. It undermines an accountable economic system. Florencia Lorenzo of the Tax Justice Network.
Legal vehicles in general, and especially those that grant limited liability, a specific type of a social pact between individuals, societies and the state, where those individuals, the legal vehicles and the corporate vehicles, they benefit from some privilege that must be followed by some duties and accountabilities, right? So if societies agree to that pact, it is only fair that they know who are they actually protecting and guaranteeing the rights, because those rights are not a fruit of nature. It's not something that is kind of given. Like, this is a pact which comes with some accountabilities. And then there's also this issue that if you are an investor, a potential commercial partner, you might not even be investing, but you're going to trade with someone. And you want to know who is the person behind the company, because, I mean, how can you trust it? From the point of view of the investors or the commercial partners, this is obviously a big issue. Transparency is fundamental.
It is. Here's Mark Boumansour of the Tax Justice Network.
It's worth highlighting here that the European Court of Justice has based its decisions on principles of privacy and human rights, which are meant to be universally applicable. But the ruling only really applies to a very narrow group of people. For most companies, at least in most parts of Europe, when they incorporate, they need to publicly register their legal owners. And for most companies, their legal owners are their beneficial owners. If I legally own a company on paper, I'm a shareholder, I make the big decisions of the company, I benefit financially from the company, I'm its legal owner and its beneficial owner. But if you've got the means and maybe the incentives to hire a team of accountants and lawyers and financial service providers, structures can be put in place to separate you from the company as a legal owner, but keep you in place as a beneficial owner. So, you know, you can put in place legal nominees, shell companies and tax havens that hide any paper trail of your legal ownership of the company, but you still get to call the big shots at the company. You still get to financially reap the rewards from the company, but hiding your legal ownership of it. And that is a form of financial secrecy. And that's what this ruling has done, really. It's upheld the supposed privacy, not of all business owners, but of a very narrow group of business owners who want to remain in secrecy, who want to remain hidden while they continue to benefit and control companies.
It is indeed a small group of people. The vast majority of us just don't have the money to purchase financial secrecy, this kind of escape to a sort of nowhere land where we can potentially buy our way out of accountability, taxes and laws that apply to everyone else. Back when nations first made ownership registers public, journalists were able to build on the good work from leaks like the Panama Papers and expose even more corruption, conflicts of interest, tax cheating and money laundering, all very much in the public interest. So what was the Lux Aviation boss worried about? Here's Florencia Lorenzo again.
There is no evidence whatsoever that making beneficial ownership information public leads to an increasing crimes against the wealthy. This sort of information, so the name, the nationality, the country where the person lives, I mean, you didn't have even the address of the person in the register. You know, it's not like you would go to a BO register to find this information. And I think that the most ridiculous part of that is the premise that anyone might need beneficial ownership information to know who the wealthy are in societies, when everyone already knows that by the neighborhoods they live in, the cars they drive, etc.
Yeah, the Michelin star restaurants and five-star hotel suites are a much better bet if you're into kidnapping and blackmail or extortion. But as you've heard from the Lux Aviation CEO's rather eye-catching dogs per flight comparisons, he's no shrinking violet. And his desire for privacy seems to be selective. This is Mark Boumansour again of the Tax Justice Network.
You've got the highest court in the European Union shutting down transparency measures that took years to put in place. These measures are a response to the Panama Papers. They're there to protect against tax evasion, corruption, money laundering, sanctions busting, you name it. And they're shutting these measures down because they're accepting and upholding the argument of a plaintiff who's saying, these measures expose me to kidnapping when I'm traveling abroad by revealing my wealth. But throughout the whole course of this case, the plaintiff is on Facebook, on Instagram, publicly posting about their travels abroad, demonstrating their wealth, posting about their luxurious private jet business. They're using Facebook's geotagging services. They're tagging, you know, publicly accessible, identifiable places they're visiting. It's unbelievable.
That sounds all too familiar to Brooke Harrington, who's done groundbreaking private wealth management research.
When you're wealthy enough to afford a wealth manager and to use offshore finance, often what you really want is simply to protect what you have from the various forces that might diminish your assets, which include taxation, debts. So the same people who don't like to pay their taxes also don't like to pay their debts. And there are high-end bounty hunters who chase these people around. Wealthy folks who don't like paying their debts also have a bad habit of bragging about their locations on Instagram. A few years ago, the Wall Street Journal ran a really interesting article on a friend of mine who is a very high-powered lawyer who was based in London at the time. And basically all he did was follow the Instagram accounts of oligarchs. And as soon as they came to the UK or particularly to London, they would post some photo of themselves at Claridge's or something. And he'd be like, right, to his team. And he'd send them to Claridge's, to the smoking room, to serve these individuals with the legal papers necessary to start the lawsuits to reclaim whatever it was they owed to my friend's clients. So taxes and debts threaten a person's fortune.
When you take a closer look at the Lux Aviation CEO, Patrick Hansen, there certainly are things he might indeed prefer to keep secret. As Luxembourg journalist Luke Caragari of Reporter.lu and colleagues reported.
Why he went to such trouble to protect his privacy? That's very simple. I mean, he's known for two big companies. The one is Lux Aviation, that's a private jet company, and the other one is Sapphire Capital Partners, which is a private equity firm. And we have discovered that Lux Aviation has received massive loans from a Russian businessman called Alexander Kolikov, who is close to Putin and who has a firm in Russia that worked on pipelines, even on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And in the same moment, private equity firm Sapphire Capital Partners holds tons of money from the same Kolikov. Generally, they are working on his investments.
There's a lot of other connections they dug up, but those kind of connections have become more controversial since the invasion of Ukraine. But some of those oligarchic connections have long raised eyebrows because of the ways many of Russia's wealthy got wealthy. And that's not all. Patrick Hansen's been owner or director of more than 117 companies registered around the world, including in well-known secrecy havens like Belize and the British Virgin Islands. There may well be more. Many of the companies he's directed had Russian beneficial owners. Not illegal, but according to experts, unnecessary complexity in corporate structures and so many directorships often raise red flags for further investigation. The Lux Aviation CEO, Patrick Hansen, says he's just a hard worker. He also says he's been fully transparent about the financing of Lux Aviation. None of his Russian business partners have been sanctioned, and any loans he's had went through banks that did compliance checks. With this privacy case that began in Luxembourg and ended up in the European Court of Justice, we didn't even know initially who was behind it. Journalist Luke Carragari again.
How did we discover Patrick Hansen's identity? Well, that's a simple one. We went to court, simply, because he was there, and a colleague of mine knew that there was a case against the UBO registry, and she went there and recognized him because he's a very public figure, and he's very well known. He likes to give interviews and boast about his businesses, but he doesn't like to be investigated, it seems.
After the European Court of Justice ruling, not all, but some European countries were super fast to shut their registries to public eyes. Patrick Hansen says that was not his aim, and he was only ever trying to protect his own privacy. But leaving aside these individuals who brought the case, achieving this European Court of Justice ruling is a real feather in the cap of the lawyers who represented them. And Brooke Harrington says this is exactly the point that governments are missing with all their big words about tackling oligarchs, financial crime and corruption.
The real center of the offshore system was not the wealthy clients everyone talks about in the newspapers. It was the gray bureaucratic people called wealth managers, the attorneys, bankers, accountants, tax advisors, etc., who are the brains of the system, because billionaires are not sitting on their yachts trying to master the tax code of the Cayman Islands or the BVI or what have you. They don't have time for that. It's too complex and it's ever-changing. So they outsource it to professionals, and those professionals are known as wealth managers, and they're like the brain trust of the whole system. They construct the offshore system for individual clients, and they manage it in a dynamic way. The center is the wealth managers. One implication of that is if you want to sanction wealthy people, what you actually need to do is knock their wealth managers out of the system or disable their wealth managers' ability to serve those oligarch clients.
These are the enablers, and they escape the attention they deserve. Brooke has recently released another groundbreaking report working with mathematicians and experts in network and complex systems analysis. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists' Offshore Leaks database offered possibilities to study offshore that didn't exist before, thanks to five massive leaks: the Pandora Papers, Paradise Papers, Bahamas Leaks, Panama Papers, and Offshore Leaks. Here she is explaining the study at a recent Tax Justice Norway event.
Our objectives were to map the structure of this semi-invisible system. You know, aristocrats and criminals have a lot in common. They use the same structures to hide their dirty work. And both of them depend for their power on dirty work. So what we found was not just a network of offshore finance. We found a very unusual kind of network. It's called a scale-free network. Very few networks are made like this. The World Wide Web, gene editing networks, airline networks, you know, that are organized around a hub. So if you've ever, like, flown through bad weather, like my hometown of Chicago notoriously gets terrible winter storms. If Chicago O'Hare Airport shuts down, pretty much the entire U.S. airline network shuts down. So that's the kind of network we're talking about. It's very robust, except if you attack those hubs. Now, imagine that transposed to the offshore system. If you've ever wondered why sanctions and blacklisting haven't worked so well, the implication here is that those efforts haven't attacked the hubs. They've attacked the spokes. So if you shut down the airport in Wichita, Kansas, you wouldn't even notice if you're flying anywhere else in the U.S. But you shut down one of the hubs, Newark Airport, Atlanta, Chicago, you're stuck. You're stuck even if you're in Los Angeles. You're not going anywhere. That's the kind of structure we're talking about. You can break the whole network simply by an intelligently targeted attack. When you look at this data set, clients come from everywhere. These are the countries that produce the highest proportion of billionaires in the world: Russia, China, the U.S., and Hong Kong. This starts to show us the shape of these secrecy networks. One of the things that is very pronounced, oligarchs operate a lot like mafiosi. That means that they want to keep the number of people who know their business, know what their wealth is and where it is, to an absolute minimum. So that means they work with a very, very, very limited number of wealth managers. That creates a hub and spoke kind of system. It creates a vulnerability. Compartmentalizing, concealing information is the name of the game here. We call these places tax havens offshore, but what they really are is secrecy havens. And secrecy, of course, is about information control. One of the ways you control information is tightly limit the number of people who know the big picture. What happens when you disrupt the networks of Russian, Chinese, Hong Kong, and U.S. oligarchs, the people who use the offshore financial system? We used a methodology common in network analysis called the knockout experiment. What happens there is you look at someone's network and you just say, let's take out one person in the network. Sort of like, are you all familiar with the game called Jenga? You know, like a little pile of sticks and then you take one or two out at a time. Well, this is like a very special game of Jenga where you target which stick you take out. And just like you'd expect in the web or with airline networks or gene editing networks, not all sticks in that system are created equal. If you take out the stick labeled wealth manager, especially in the Jenga piles for Russian and Chinese oligarchs, the whole tower comes down. That is a very important piece of information if you're a policymaker, because it means don't waste your time sanctioning the wealthy people. Turns out also, not only do Chinese and Russian oligarchs concentrate their secrets among one or two wealth managers, they concentrate geographically for a variety of reasons. So if you just pull out the 26 sanctioned oligarchs who appear in the ICIJ database, you get some very interesting pictures. Most of those 26 sanctioned Russian oligarchs have already been sanctioned multiple times, but were able to evade the effect of sanctions. They move themselves around or they move their assets around. And of course, when I say they, I mean their wealth managers. So one of the problems for public policy is it's really hard to sanction the ultra wealthy, just like it's hard to shut down or sanction offshore financial centers that abuse the law. Well, one of the reasons for that we've discovered is that the sanctions are targeting the wrong thing. They're targeting the oligarchs. You can take out oligarchs' access to one or two offshore piles of money. But if you really want to shut them down, what our work shows is you got to get their wealth managers. And those wealth managers are named in the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers and the Pandora Papers. So we know who they are. So if what you really want to do is cut off bad guys from their offshore wealth, what we're showing quantitatively is the way to do it is make it so the wealth managers can't serve them. There's a very long history of doing this in the law. And starting at the end of the Second World War, There were rules about which experts could share information about nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons with whom. So that's the model that we're suggesting can be applied to wealth managers. The message from governments, and this is already being done in the US, the UK, and the EU, the message to wealth managers is go ahead, practice your profession, you're not constrained, except that you can't work with these sanctioned individuals. That sounds pretty reasonable, right? But that would have a massive impact, and that's what we've demonstrated in this work. Sanctions against elites may be ineffective, but sanctioning their wealth managers is likely to be extremely effective if there's a political will to do it.
Yes. Brooke Harrington there. What she's saying about wealth managers could potentially be applied to other enablers, like lawyers. In fact, there's a surprisingly small elite group of legal firms that serve oligarchs and the super wealthy. Big lawyer company Mishkondareya represented the Lux Aviation CEO, managing to end public access to registers of beneficial owners. While Mishkondareya may also take on many worthy and good cases, until recently they ran a specifically named VIP Russia service specialising in reputation protection, wealth structuring and asset protection for high net worth Russians. They've removed that page from their website and they've said they don't serve any sanctioned Russians. Mishkondareya was also hired, by the way, to defend the reputation of a wealthy client doing business in Malta against investigations by the Maltese journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia, who was sadly assassinated. According to her sons, that legal action sought to cripple her financially with libel action in UK courts. Even if journalists weren't, once again, so constrained in many jurisdictions in accessing information on beneficial ownership registers, leaks like the Panama Papers will continue to be inevitable because the system for the extremely wealthy and powerful is still so secretive, and there are people working within that system that understand the damage. No doubt about it. Political will really is key. Governments could stop a lot of crime and corruption in its tracks very quickly if they really wanted to. The question is how close they are to those who benefit from financial secrecy and how much they themselves use it. Governments are failing on financial transparency and they don't properly fund enforcement that we know would make corruption much more difficult. Last word goes to the Tax Justice Network's Florencia Lorenzo.
It's a very hypocritical thing that the wealthy do not care about identifying when this is like a social distinction, when you want to make sure people know that you have more power. But when you're to be kept accountable, you do not allow authorities to make any information public. So I think that this is ridiculous. And I think that maybe that's one of the most outrageous elements of the ruling for those that are concerned with social justice, is that it tries to embed the decision within the context of human rights language. Because, I mean, how can you actually guarantee human rights are being respected within the context of the opacity? This ruling is undermining transparency and accountability, which is a core element of any framework that seeks to guarantee human rights. Civil society organizations and journalists make hugely important work in terms of keeping companies and other legal vehicles accountable. Some local groups might also be interested in keeping track of some entities, and they won't be able to do that, or they will have to make like a huge effort to access this information. So if, for instance, now if you're talking about environmental crimes that some community might be dealing with, a lot of those crimes are actually protected by corporate opacity. So if local communities want to access who is the person that is actually committing those crimes, they're going to have to fight a very upward battle. It's not going to be simple.
That's it for now on the TaxCast. Thanks for listening. There's lots of further reading on this episode in the show notes and on our website, www.thetaxcast.com. So take a look. We'll cover in more detail soon the role of taxes in the climate crisis. We'll be back with you next month. Bye for now.